nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
All right, let's start. Today we're going to focus on how plasmonic structures can be used to guide light on nanoscale. As we discussed before, conventional light guiding structures such as waveguide fibers, they're pretty big in size. They have to be on the scale of wavelengths or larger, so they are basically micron scale structures. The same is true about photonic crystals, which are, of course, very efficient guiding structures for light, but still they are micron or at best submicron scale. And plasmonic structures, which can be as small as 10 nanometers in size only, can efficiently guide light on much smaller scale. So that's their big advantage. Of course, the trade-off that losses are typically much larger in metallic structures. But if your device is small itself, if you don't need to guide light over large distances, then it might be not that big a problem. All right. Let me just first remind what you covered last time. We considered how plasmons can be excited. When I say plasmons we use in a pretty general sense. When we speak of propagating plasmons, we should say surface plasmon polariton. With the word polariton, we emphasize that it is a wave which propagates with certain speed and has a certain wavelength. When we say simply surface plasmons, we usually imply structures much smaller than the wavelength, so we assume non-propagating regime, like quasi-static regime, so that the retardation effects are of no importance, the wavelength is of no importance, the only thing which matters is the frequency. But sometimes we call by this word surface plasmons, simply plasmons, both cases, just for the sake of simplicity. And last time we considered specifically surface plasmon polaritons, waves. And there is some problem involved in terms of excitation of these waves. And that has to do with the fact that momentum of surface plasmon polaritons is larger than momentum of a photon. Therefore, unless you play some trick, you actually cannot excite surface plasmon polariton directly, because that would violate momentum conservation. And one of those tricks is actually shown here. You use this so-called Kretschmann geometry. And the idea here that you need to have this longitudinal component of light in silica, because the prism here is made of silica, to be equal to the wave vector of the surface plasmon polariton. However, if surface plasmon polariton propagates on the upper interface of this thin metal film, then in principle it could match the longitudinal component of light because of this prefactor square root of epsilon t. If it would be in air, you never can fulfill this condition simply because Ksp is always larger than omega of c. And sine theta is always less than 1. However, because you have this prefactor, because light actually propagates, exciting light propagates through glass, because of this prefactor, you actually can fulfill this condition. So the trick is that you match actually the longitudinal component of light in glass so that you have this additional prefactor to the wave vector of surface plasmon polariton propagating on the upper interface of the metal film. Of course, this is possible only if the metal film is very thin, so that the electromagnetic energy can tunnel from the bottom to the upper interface of the film. So this is well-known Kretschmann geometry, which is commonly used in the lab to excite surface plasmon polariton. And as I said, the trick is this prefactor, which allows to match the two momenta. Another very common way is to use not a flat metal film, but periodic metal film. If you have a certain periodicity with such a period that in the wave vector space, in the momentum space, you have this g, then to fulfill momentum, you have actually this extra parameter g, so that the momentum conservation would look in this case, as it's given by this formula, the longitudinal component of light has to be equal to the momentum of surface plasmon polariton plus or minus m times g, where g is just characterizes the grating. Okay, so the periodicity, because you have a periodicity when you decompose it in Fourier series, it gives you different types of momenta, g, integer of g, 1g, 2g, 3g, and so on. And that allows you to use to fulfill momentum conservation, because the periodicity is always associated with certain momentum. And that gives you that extra momentum which you need to match the momentum of surface plasmon polariton and to have this condition fulfilled. Okay, so the second way to excite surface plasmon polaritons is basically to corrugate your film, to introduce certain periodicity. You have to realize that if your film is random, then it still could be thought as just a series, a continuous series of periodical gratings. And on rough surface, you still can excite surface plasmon polariton. The problem, though, that if roughness is really strong, then SPPs scatter a lot and don't propagate much. They actually get localized in many cases, as we will consider later. So finally, if you have a very small feature, such as a metal quantum dot, then in principle, you can excite surface plasmon polariton through this feature. And the idea is here is also rather simple. If you have something which is small, let's say it have certain size A, in the inverse Fourier space, it means that you have 1 over A distribution over the wave vector. Okay, so you're actually introducing the K space, the distribution of K vectors, which is roughly 1 over A, because you have this simple relation delta K times delta X is order of one. This is simply the property of Fourier decomposition. It has nothing to do with quantum mechanics, as people often confuse. It's just the property of Fourier decomposition. So if you have, let's say, some special function which is concentrating in the area A, then in the K space, when you do Fourier decomposition, you would be distribution over K vectors in the range delta K, which is roughly 1 over A. So if you have a very small feature, it means that actually I have like certain range of k vectors available, which again allow me to fulfill momentum conservation. Or in a different way, you could say that if your structure is actually confined in space, that the momentum is not really a good quantum number. You basically don't care about this, because momentum is a quantum number which needs to be conserved only in the case if your system is homogeneous or periodical. Either way, whatever you prefer to think of this, but in either way, if your structure is small in space, then it could serve as a source of this propagating surface plasmon polaritons. So you excite with light this quantum dot, which works as a series like small non-antenna, and then that there are these propagating plasmon polaritons propagating away from this point source, as it's clearly seen here. So this is the third way to excite surface plasmon polariton. And also, we discussed different guiding geometries, such as these stripes or wires. You can see clearly here as surface plasmon polariton propagates. In fact, you can see the interference picture because it propagates and then it gets reflected from the end of this stripe and it forms this standing wave, which you can clearly see here. And yet another way to guide surface plasmon polariton is to use this channel in photonic crystals. And remember, again, photonic crystals are structures which, because of the interference and multiple scattering, because of the Bragg reflection, do have certain energy gaps where light cannot propagate. However, when you create defects such as those linear defects, then light can exist within these defects, but cannot penetrate inside of the crystal because the frequency is exactly in the band gap. So therefore, the guiding in this case occurs only along these defects, basically, linear defects, which serve as a channel for propagating of light. And today, we're going to spend quite a while considering special way of propagating light based on nanoparticle arrays. That was developed to a large extent by a group in Caltech, led by Harry Atwater, and a number of younger people working with him now, like Mark Brongersma. He is now a professor at Stanford, and he is actually the one with whom we developed this course and working now on textbooks. Mark Brongersma was one of the co-authors on this series of papers published on guiding light in nanoparticle arrays. All right. Stefan Meyer is yet another. There were two postdocs working with Harry Atwater at Caltech at the time they did all this work. Stefan Meyer, who is now in UK, Mark Brongersma, who is at Stanford, and Harry Atwater, he's still in Caltech. So what is the idea? You have a series of these spheres, metallic spheres. And you can excite one sphere, for example, by using near-field optical microscope. With the tip of near-field optical microscope, you deliver light through a fiber, tapered fiber, and excite just a single particle. And then that excitation, because particles do interact with each other, would propagate. And that's a special type of surface plasmon polariton. In this case, it propagates not alone a flat metal surface, but rather along a chain of metal particles. So this is a schematic of the experiment they did. This is a scanning electron microscope image of a chain of gold particles, which they fabricate. In fact, since Maxwell's equations scale with the wavelengths, the same physics can be checked in the microwave range rather than in the optical range, because it's much easier to fabricate structures in this case. Instead of having this 50 nanometer size gold nanoparticles, you could use these rather big poles, which are centimeter in size, and see whether you can guide microwave radiation along these roads. And since the physics should be similar, you could expect if it works in this case, it should work also in the optical range. Having this said, I should add that it's not exactly right because there are some new physical things which become important in the optical range. And to be specific, in the microwave range, metal has enormously large epsilon, and actually metal behaves like almost like perfect conductor, whereas in the optical range, epsilon is finite and small, and you can excite so-called plasmon resonances. So some new physical phenomena becomes important. So there is, of course, some scaling between microwave and optical range, but there are also some nuances, some specifics, which are very important when you move from the microwave range to the optical range. Still, of course, it's very nice to check the same idea by using this microwave experiment. So in this case, they have a source of 8 gigahertz, as it's shown here. So they have these poles, metallic copper rods, and they excite the, with this antenna, they excite this rod, and then the excitation propagates along the chain of these rods. And here you can see the simulations that they performed. So some specifics, so 90% of the energy is confined within a distance given by 0.05 lambda Fermi, and 3-4 dB loss at the corner occurs here due to far field radiation. So there are some losses occurring at the corner. All right, let's now consider in more detail how actually the electromagnetic energy or the surface plasmon polariton propagates along a chain of metal particles. Let's come back to the optical range. Okay, so for this, let's recall the basics. Let's say we have a single silver or gold particle, say 50 nanometers in size, and you excite it with the field so that the electrical field is polarized vertically. And what it will happen that since electrons are free to move in metal, they will be displaced. You would have excessive charge from one side, negative charge, and excessive positive charge on the other side. And when you have this situation, indeed, there is a restoring force which tends to return electrons to the equilibrium position so that electrons would start bounce up and down with the frequency which is given by the so-called surface plasmon resonant frequency. Okay? So electrical field is just a driving force, but there is internal fundamental frequency of this oscillator. This works just a classical oscillator with a cloud of electrons oscillating, representing this classical oscillator. And the restoring force, of course, depends on the surface charge formed in this case. Therefore, the restoring force or the frequency of this surface plasmon resonance is very sensitive to the shape of your particle. If you take not a sphere but a spheroid, then the distribution of the surface charge would be different and the frequency of oscillation would be different. And as I pointed out earlier, this is a very nice way to control the frequency of this non-antenna, if you wish. And again, I keep saying that this structure acts like non-antenna because metal which has negative epsilon could be thought as inductance L with optical frequency, and the surrounding host with positive epsilon could be thought of as just a capacitance, again, optical capacitance, that all together they form optical LC circuit, or if you wish, dipole antenna, non-antenna. So this is quite common language now, call these structures optical non-antenna, as opposed to conventional antennas, the oscillated optical frequencies. Okay, you excite the first particle, but let's say if there are, what happened then? There are, of course, these field lines connecting the positive and negative charges, as it's shown here, the field lines. And if now I place here another particle, then these field lines would for sure excite that particle too. And that's exactly what happens. Let's place there the next particle. And since I have here these field lines, that would then what would happen? Clearly, that then I would have here negative charges and here positive charges. All right? And sure enough, that's what we have. So then this second particle creates again the field lines going from positive to negative charges. So if I place the next particle here, then what should I expect here? Would I have negative charges? Here I would have positive charges. Okay? And that's the physics. That's the way this plasmon excitation from the first particle starts to propagate to the second, to the third, and so on. And we get this surface plasmon polariton propagating over the chain of plasmonic particles. Okay? That's what we have in the end. So clearly what we have here, it's kind of transverse wave because oscillations occur in the direction perpendicular to the propagation of line, to the propagation of wave. But the very interesting thing to notice, if I now make this perpendicular chain right here, then from the physics it's clear, from the physics of this electrical field line, it's clear that here I would excite the longitudinal wave with the charges oscillating in the same direction as the wave propagates. You see what's going on? Here I have a transverse wave, but if I now have a perpendicular chain of particles, here it converts into the longitudinal wave, as very clearly could be seen just by looking at these field lines. So this is what is summarized here. Light can penetrate metallic nanoparticles and set electrons in motion. This is the big difference between microwave and optical range. In microwave, because metals behave basically as like perfect conductors, the skin depth is much smaller than the size of any structure. Field does not penetrate inside of metal in the case of microwave. Or let's say the depth of penetration is negligible with the size of the structure. Here, the typical skin depth in the optical range is 20 nanometers. The size of the particle is 10, 20 nanometers. Basically, light penetrates through all the structure. Okay? That's entirely different story. And so the next statement, the collection, like the collective electron motion, is called the plasmon. That's what we call plasmon. In most cases, we actually speak of surface plasmons because it's always related to these surface charges. There is also bulk plasmon. That has to do with really bulk material. But it's in most cases of no interest for us because the plasmon frequency is in it's 9 eV. It's basically deep UV. It's not the visible range, and there is no, let's say, applications which would be related to the optical range which we are considering. In our case, all these plasmonic excitations are basically surface plasmon excitations. They are related to this surface charge. So they are strongly sensitive to the what kind of shape of particles we have.
Sir,
yes?
This works only as long as the field which does the excitation, the wave, the frequency is lower, is less than the plasma frequency.
No. It should be close to the plasma frequency. But when you say plasma frequency, what do you mean? Plasma surface for single particle?
For the single particle.
Right. Okay, so we will see in a moment that it's not exactly right what you said. So in both cases, when frequency is above or below the resonant frequency with single particles, you can excite different modes. There are different modes which exist here, and they all ranged near the resonant frequency with single particle. And these modes can have both higher or smaller frequency, as we will see in a couple minutes.
Yeah?
So, high frequency, how do you stop electric field in the first cluster?
Say it again?
How do you stop the electric field for the first cluster?
Okay, so for example, as I pointed out in one of previous slides, I could bring here a tip of a near-field optical microscope, which can be as small in size as, let's say, 50 nanometers. It's basically a fiber, tapered fiber, which at the very end, as small as 50 nanometers. And you can position that tip exactly above this single particle, and you deliver light locally to this single particle. So this near-field scanning optical microscope, which will be a subject of one of our lectures, is absolutely critical apparatus for the whole nanophotonics because it allows you to excite on nanoscale and to detect on nanoscale. It's a good question, and it wouldn't be possible unless people develop this outstanding apparatus, which is called near-field scanning optical microscope, which allows both detection and excitation with nanoscale selectivity. All right, so what else I put here? Plasmonics, it's basically guiding light along metallic nanostructures. When we say plasmonics, we mean in general as a field. It's basically different ways to guide, control, manipulate light on nanoscale. And since the only way to do this manipulation is, or let's say the most important way to do this manipulation is involve this surface plasmon, therefore it's called plasmonics. In principle, there are other ways, like materials with extremely large epsilon, such as silicon. You can concentrate light in that case also quite strongly, because refractive index is large. But still, you never can concentrate it down to like 10 nanometers, as you can in the case of surface plasmons. Well, losses are large. That's the trade-off. In this particular case, they are enormously large, like 3 dB per micron. But again, if your device is small, if the whole device is, let's say, 1 micron in size, then it could be manageable. And I should say also, to guide light through this chain of nanoparticles is far from being the most efficient ways. We consider it's almost like historically, because that was first suggested, but there are better ways, more efficient ways to guide light on nanoscale than using this chain of particles. All right, but we start anyway from the resonance of a single particle, as was pointed out, and therefore the critical thing is just to excite this plasmon excitation in a single particle. Therefore, let's recall how that excitation looks like. And for that, let's recall this absorption cross-section, which has this structure. Epsilon for metals has real part and imaginary part. And remember that epsilon is well described by the Drude formula. And that real part of epsilon is negative. It's very important for frequency below the plasma frequency. And imaginary part, unfortunately, smaller than the real one, but still quite large. And the imaginary part is responsible for larger losses. As for host matrix, we could assume it's purely real. Like if you take silica or alumina, there is basically no losses. You can ignore any losses. So that's our host. And you can see that the resonance occurs when the real part of dielectric permittivity of metal is equal to minus 2 epsilon h. That's the resonance. In this case, the absorption cross-section dramatically increases. So in other words, in this case, the frequency coincides with the frequency of this restoring force I was talking about. The restoring force and the fundamental frequency of oscillation is given by exactly this condition when epsilon 1 is equal to minus 2 epsilon h. And the key thing is to appreciate here that the position of that resonance, I told you, depends on the shape, but now we're considering only a sphere. For sphere, it's fixed. But it also depends on the host into which this sphere is embedded. And typically, the larger, not typically, but exactly, the larger epsilon h, the more frequency is shifted toward the red part of the spectrum. When you increase the dielectric constant of your host, then the frequency of this plasmon resonance moves toward the longer wavelengths. Okay, as it's shown here, let's say for vacuum and for silver, you have the resonance at around 340 nanometers. When you take 1.5 glass, so you have the resonance at around 400 nanometers. When you have 3.3, which is what, close to silicon, so you get the resonance at 700 nanometers. So by changing the host and keeping the same metal particle, you control also the frequency at which that particle resonates through this restoring force occurring in the particle. Okay, so that's very important. That's a pretty old theory, actually, comes down to me, which he developed in the beginning of previous century. So that particular calculation are done for silver nanoparticle, which has 10 nanometer in size. And roughly in the range of sizes between 10 to 50 nanometers, the position of the resonance and the width of the resonance do not depend on the size of the particle. They do depend on the shape, but don't depend on the size of a particle. When particle becomes too large, then retardation effect, radiation losses become important, like multipolar contributions become important. Therefore, the quality factor becomes smaller, the quality factor of the resonance. When particle is too small, like 5 nanometers, electrons start scatter strongly at the boundaries of your sphere, and therefore the quality factor also goes down. And clearly, the quality factor depends on how small the imaginary part, because when you have zero here, you still have the imaginary part. So the quality factor depends on how small the imaginary part. So, but as a practical advice, so in terms of the best enhancement, the highest local field you can obtain, the largest quality factors, the size of these gold or silver particles, which are two best metals, should be in the range between 5 to 50 nanometers, roughly. Okay. I'd like to emphasize some point that when you off resonance and you irradiate a particle of certain size, then all light which is relatively far from the particle basically doesn't feel that particle. There is no much interaction. You are off the resonance. Therefore, the cross-section off resonance is roughly the size of the particle squared. That's what is the optical cross-section. However, if you excite, if the frequency of your light is close to the resonant frequency of the particle, then even far away from the particle, there is strong modification in field lines of the propagating external field, which means that there is strong interaction even far away from the particle. In other words, the cross-section in this case is by far larger than the size of the particle squared. And it turns out, if you do accurate calculations, that at the resonance, the cross-section of your particle goes from the size squared up to the wavelength squared. And that's true for any particle. If you consider just atom, an interaction of atom with light, if light is off resonance, then the optical cross-section would be just one angstrom squared, because typical size of atom is one angstrom. Okay? But if you excite that atom at the resonance, exactly the resonance, it turns out that the cross-sections becomes wavelength squared. The wavelength in the visible is, let's say, 1 micron. It's 10 to the minus 4 centimeters. One angstrom is 10 to the minus 8 centimeters. When you square that, you see that the difference is 10 to the 8. In other words, difference between resonant and off-resonant excitation is 100 million times. When you hit the resonance, the efficiency of interaction increases by 100 million times. You could think of this as like, because of the resonance, particle behaves itself as it would have a size 10,000 times larger than it has in reality. And since in terms of the cross-section you have to square this, you get this 100 million times increase in efficiency. So the resonance is a huge thing. It makes a huge difference. Of course, again, the trade-off, when you have resonance, you have dramatic increase in local fields, but it is always accompanied by increasing losses. So sometimes it's not important, sometimes it is important. But nothing comes for free. Okay, this is a more illustration how actually the surface plasmon propagate through a chain of particle. So you see, you can see a particular wave. So like the dipole moment here is zero, then it increases, reaches maximum here, then it decreases and becomes zero here again. D is the distance between the particles. Here we simply numerate the particle, and this is the wavelengths. And the wavelengths could be anything like this, which is equal distance between the particle, or basically like the whole chain. And that's all different modes of our system. So, and this near-field interaction sets up these dipole plasmon waves. Let me emphasize again, there are two types of waves, transverse. This is what we see now is a transverse and longitudinal modes. For longitudinal modes, the dipole moment would be oriented along the chain. And what is really important here, that these different particles interact via the field created by dipole moments. The dipole moment creates a field which has three different terms. One of the terms goes like 1 over r cubed, and this term dominates in the near zone. In other words, at the distance is much smaller than the wavelength. Sometimes it's called Forster field. So there is intermediate term, which goes like 1 over r squared. And in the far zone, the dominating term is 1 over r. We know that in the far zone, the distance is much larger than the wavelengths. The field decreases like 1 over r, or in other words, intensity decreases like 1 over r squared. But that's very important. If you look at any textbook on electrodynamics, the field produced by dipole moment has three terms. And this term, when the distance is much smaller than the wavelength, is much larger than the two others. Therefore, the approximation we're going to use, because all these particles are very close to each other, then the field, let's say if we consider the field created by this dipole moment and acting on this particle, would be mainly dominated by this term. Because this term gives by far larger contribution to the field than this term. So in other words, the approximation is we keep only this term and we assume that the interaction, and since this term decreases so fast, then the interaction will be dominant between nearest neighbors. Okay? Since the whole structure much smaller than the wavelengths, then the near field is the largest. But since it decreases so fast, like 1 over r cubed, the interaction, the field, let's say, which this particle fields coming from this dipole is by 8 times larger than the field coming from this particle. Therefore, for simplicity, we take into account interaction between only nearest neighbors, and we assume that the interaction goes like 1 over d cubed, where d is distance between the particle. This is approximation, but it's reasonable. Okay, so the interaction between the dipoles goes like 1 over d cubed, where d is the separation between the nearest particle. So that's what I put here. When d is much larger than lambda, the Foster field dominates. Nearest neighbor interaction plays a most important role. Okay, then the equation becomes simple. This is just the dipole moment. Dipole moment, again, is charge times displacement. So this is just Newton's second law, okay? X double dot, or acceleration, times charge, which gives you the dipole moment, is equal, this is the term that, which describes the plasmon resonance of a single particle, which is still there. Even without any interaction, we have this term, simply restoring force, okay? That's the surface plasmon resonance of individual particle. And this is the interaction with two nearest neighbor. One has number m minus 1 and m plus 1. They are two nearest neighbor. And you can see that it goes like 1 over d cubed. This is density of charges times the volume gives you the total charge. So, and this is just refractive squared. This is nothing but the field, which is d over r cube. The field, sorry, not d but p. The field created by the dipole moment p in the near zone is just p divided by r cube. R in this case is d cube. And p itself is proportional to the charge and the displacement. So it's very straightforward to derive this equation, and I suggested you to do it. It's homework exercise. It's 5-minute exercise. So it's basically you write displacement for electrons and the force acting on electrons. One is the restoring force within the particle itself, and another force is the field created by the dipole moment of the nearest particle. And that field goes as the dipole moment divided by the distance cubed. That's what is written here. This prefactor gamma depends on the geometry, because if the two dipoles look like this, and then the interaction is actually twice less than if two dipoles looks like this, and the sign is different. Okay, that's again, it's the basics of electrodynamics. So this gamma is equal one for the transverse wave when two dipole moments looks up, and minus two when they look along the chain. So therefore the interaction is larger in terms of magnitude and has a different sign. So this is the transfer, this is longitudinal. And then you look at the solution in the form of this propagating wave. So you substitute this into here. This is a standard procedure which is used in solid state. When you consider phonons or whatever, any polaritons, I mean magnons, spinons, any excitations in a solid state, if you have a periodical system, you do the same way. You write this equation, and you look for solution in the form of this propagating wave, and you end up with this dispersion relation. For a single chain, again, those who studied phonons, if you have a single chain, just simple particles connected by springs, you get exactly the same solution. Okay, so this is a dispersion relation, which gives you frequency of these waves as a function of the wave vector. Okay, and this coming back to your question, you see the frequency starts from omega naught, which is the frequency of a single particle, but it also can be larger or smaller depending on which mode you excite. And different modes are characterized by different k wave vector or different wavelengths of the mode. There are modes which have the wavelengths equal to the separation between the particles, and there is a mode which is equal to the length of the whole chain. And depending on that, you have a different frequency. So that's what is shown here. For the transverse mode, for example, it goes like this. And for the longitudinal mode, it goes like this. Okay, and in the center, when k equals zero means that the wavelength is infinite. That means the whole sample is excited as a whole. I mean, all particles basically excited in unison. They go together, up and down, or this way, or this way. So we have for the transverse excitation, we have the frequency like this, and for the longitudinal excitation, we have a frequency like this. And of course, there are points where the frequency exactly coincides with the frequency of individual particle. So this is the dispersion relations for transverse and longitudinal waves. So it gives you, again, the dependence of frequency as a function of k, frequency as a function of the wave vector. It's a very standard way for any solid state excitation. And in this case, we are speaking of surface plasmons. That's all the difference. Yeah.
Is the dotted versus solid line just one that counts for all three components of the dipole field?
Right. The solid lines versus dashed line, it's two different calculations. When you take into account only the nearest neighbor and then take into account the interaction with other members, and you see that it works pretty well. All right, so, by the way, another interesting thing, the group velocity, what velocity with which these surface plasmons propagate, it's the group velocity, and it's given by d omega over dk. And it's different from speed of light, indeed. So it turns out, if you use the numbers, it turns out to be, in this particular case, 3.4 10 to the 6 meter per second. So it's 100 times slower than the speed of light, which means that the wavelengths would be 100 times shorter, right? So since the frequency is the same, okay, the speed is less and the wavelength is 100 times shorter. That's the idea of the whole this surface plasmons. So what you do, actually, you can squeeze light into new type of waves which have much shorter wavelengths. But since the frequency is fixed, it also assumes that the speed with which it propagates also becomes smaller than the speed of light. But due to the same reasons, these excitations are more prone to losses. Just try to get the big picture. What you do, you convert light into the surface plasmon excitation, which have much shorter wavelengths. Therefore, they're by far better suited for nanoscale interaction, because you convert something which originally has micron scale wavelengths to nanoscale wavelengths. But since frequency is fixed, wavelengths are smaller, of course, the speed becomes is much smaller, all right? And that implies that losses, that these waves are more prone to losses. The slower propagation of a wave, typically, the more they are prone to losses. They have more time to get all the damage for everything possible, to decay from all possible mechanisms. All right, so some funny things which could be used with these chains in terms of applications. We actually discussed already this. So you send a wave which is longitudinal, then you have this corner, and from here you get transverse wave. Okay, so what actually happened, originally you have this wave with this frequency and this wave vector. And when it turns around the corner, it jumps to this wave. It has to have the same frequency indeed, but now it belongs to this branch, and it has that wavelength, wave vector. So actually, that's at the corner, that's what happens. You jump from this point to this point. So what they did, they calculated power transmission coefficient from this point to this one. And let's see what they obtained. For this particular case, let's say it turns out the power conversion efficiency is 8/9 from longitudinal to transverse, and the same from transverse to longitudinal. And if you have a combination like this, when longitudinal is transverse, is converted into two transverse waves, and of course, because of the symmetry clear, half will go here, half will go here. So that the conversion efficiency into transverse wave in this case is 64% for all possible corner and T structures. Oops. Well, a little bit how they fabricated these particles. One of the ways is just use this AFM manipulation. They basically use AFM and place particle by particle. And they would get these chains, which don't look this nice, and that's probably not the best way to do the fabrication, but that's what they started from. This slide describes how vulnerable this structure to any type of defects and disorder. What kind of disorder and defects we could have here? For example, the periodicity should be not the same through the chain. Let's say if you have small deviation in periodicity in the distance between neighbor particles, that would result in some change in the conversion efficiency. And for example, if you have this delta D over D 5%, then that would result in this conversion efficiency going down to 96%. Another thing is size fluctuations. One of the particles could be larger, for example. And in this case, you can also calculate how it affects the conversion, efficiency, and it would go down to 90%. So there is also intrinsic losses, of course, because losses occur just even if there are no any defects, simply because you convert electromagnetic energy to heat. That also decreases the conversion efficiency. This is a better way to do this array of particles using e-beam. In this case, you have this, you put positive photoresist. With e-beam, you make this periodical structure. Then you deposit metal, as it's shown here. And then you lift off the parts which have this photoresist underneath. So you would end up with periodical array of particles. So then again, by using this tip near-field optical microscope, you can excite particles at the end and consider how it propagates along the chain. So here you can see these chains of particle obtained by using this e-beam lithography. That looks pretty nice now. And this is the results where they looked how the transverse mode different from longitudinal mode. So they excite this white light source, and they put here a polarizer so that one time you have a light which polarized like this and excites only longitudinal mode, and then for a different polarizer, they would excite it with light which polarized like this so that you excite only transverse mode. And then you obtain these two different modes, different bands which shifted with respect to each other. And the center of the transverse mode is shifted with respect to the center of the longitudinal band by a certain amount. And by the way, since in this case the wavelength is much larger than the size of the separation between the particles, you excite the mode with k equals 0. Here we speak of the mode with k equals 0 because you excite the whole chain in unison. So basically what we are looking here is the shift between the longitudinal and transverse mode for k equals 0. So that's exactly what we are looking here. That's k equals 0, and that shift, so that's what is measured in that experiment. With transverse polarization, you excite all the particles like this. With longitudinal polarization, you excite all particles like this. And the difference in the position of these two bands gives you exactly this difference. So you can compare theory against experiment by doing this. And here you can see how the difference between the two centers shrinks with increasing the spacing between the particles. When you increase the spacing between the particles, they basically become independent, and they all start resonating at single frequency omega naught because no interaction. When the spacing is small, then the interaction is important, and the interaction for this type of dipoles and this type of dipoles is different, and that's what you actually obtain. So some experiment which prove that indeed these surface plasmons propagate along the chain of particles. The experiment they done at Caltech was looking like this. So again, they excited the particle with a tip of near-field optical microscope. And then they placed in some particular point of this chain a dye molecule. If the surface plasmon excitation reaches this point where your dye molecule sits, then dye molecule would get excited and would start radiate. And you can see the radiation of light going from dye molecule. Okay? And the idea here that if there is no any transport, then you would not see light coming from dye molecule. If there is a transport, then you do see light coming from dye molecule. And they scan. So they move tip from here to here, and then to this part. Clearly, when the tip is far away, very little of surface plasmon excitations come to dye, so very little light you would obtain. When the tip sits right in front of the dye, you get most of the light because you get the most efficient excitation. And then when you move again to that direction, so the intensity of light will disappear. However, if there would not be propagation of surface plasmon, then you would have light only when the tip sits right on top of the dye. And what was obtained? Well, this is again these boron particles. Let's not spend much time on this. What they obtain is that indeed this is our dye molecule, and you scan the tip, and indeed you do have signal even when your tip is far away from the position of the dye. So, and these two, we have two curves here and two curves here. In this case, the dye was a little bit farther from the chain of particles, so it didn't interact that strongly with the chain of particles. Therefore, the tip has to be closer to the dye to excite it. Whereas in the second case, the dye molecule was sitting right on the chain, so therefore the tip, even when it is pretty far from the position of the dye molecule, it still excites the dye molecule through propagation of surface plasmon along the chain. So clearly this does prove that this chain of particles propagate electromagnetic energy through themselves. Very nice experiment. Well, for what kind of things it could be used, I mean, these chains of particles could be used as a guiding structures for nanophotonic chips. And as opposed to, let's say, fibers or whatever, they are nanostructures. So therefore, one could envision things like you deliver light through a fiber, then you somehow couple light from a fiber to these particles, and then you make all these divisions. You can redirect light, but the point here that the all energy is concentrated to nanoscale. So in principle, you could guide light with structures which are nanoscale-like. Here is a more envisionary nanophotonic chip, which basically combines ideas of photonic crystals and these plasmonic structures. Again, it's not what already exists. It's what something could be done in future. So what is the idea? It's kind of hypothetical chip. So you deliver light through fibers. Some information comes through fibers. And there is no replacement for fibers, because this is the cheapest way to send information, let's say, over large distance, such over ocean and anyway. So you got some information. You deliver it to a chip. You want to process that information. Then you have this very efficient couplers, which could be like metallic nano-antennas, which convert light at 1.5 micron coming through a fiber to very efficient nano-antenna irradiating at 1.5 micron. So then you can use, hey, you have here this wavelength division multiplication, so you send signal at different frequency to different channels. So then you can switch it with optical cross-connect, which could be controlled electronically. And ideally, of course, at least in the near future, you should have combination of electronic control and optical signal processing, because optics is faster, but electronics is much cheaper. And when you can use electronic, you should use electronic. Electronic devices, of course, are fantastic now. So you can make delay lines. Like, for example, if you have this photonic, by the way, this photonic waveguide, sometimes they're called photonic wires, could be used for passive waveguiding. Although these structures are not that small, they could be, well, 200 nanometers, 300 nanometers or so, but they very efficiently guide light. And in this case, actually, losses are very low. And if you add some metallic structures which resonate with this light, you could introduce delay lines, which is very important for this chip. You do need sometimes delay lines. So by placing some metallic structures within these waveguides, you can have delay lines as pointed here. You can also have photonics switch here by using this Mach Zehnder interferometer, which has these two arms. And when you apply voltage to one of the arms, you can change the refractive index slightly. And therefore, you can make it so that at the end of this interferometer, the interference, either constructive or destructive. In other words, the signal either goes through or doesn't go through. So it works like a switch, which again could be controlled electronically. So you can have these guides through these photonic crystals. Again, the advantage of these photonic crystal waveguides, they have very low losses. But metal structures provide functionality on nanoscale. So that's the kind of complementary to each other. Like this fiber coupler, when you place here a metal particle, could really concentrate light to nanoscale. You start from a big, from a wave which is actually several micron in size from a beam, and then you concentrate it to nanoscale. You can also do this plasmonic photodetector by creating, let's say, a cavity inside of a photonic crystal and placing inside of that cavity this like bow tie-like nano-antenna. A cavity inside of a photonic crystal can concentrate energy on the scale of, let's say, several hundred nanometers, okay, which is great. But this nano-antenna, like bow tie nano-antenna, can further concentrate energy down to 10 nanometer scale and increase dramatically sensitivity of a photodetector. So as I said, this is kind of a hypothetical chip, but it combines the ideas of very low loss passive wave guiding by using various silicon structure. And of course, electronics always based on CMOS fabrication, so therefore silicon has to be there. Either conventional silicon waveguide, like rich waveguides, or maybe photonic crystal wire-like waveguides. And by introducing metallic nanostructures, which we are studying, you can create efficient couplers to nanoscale, you can create efficient delay lines, you can create very efficient photodetectors, and also these switches. So therefore, realistically, photonic, silicon photonic, nanophotonic chips of the near future would have all these components, electronic ones and optical ones. And optical ones, when we want them to squeeze, to shrink down to nanoscale, have to involve metallic structures. And the thing to keep in mind, anyway, photonic chips, current chips already have metal there. They have copper there, okay? So, and we, when you go to very small sizes, like 10, 50 nanometer size, you go to the sizes where plasmon resonances can be excited. You can start taking advantage of all these phenomena that we are studying now. So in terms of nanophotonics, things we are studying, it's still the future, although I believe the very near future. It's a question of 2, 3, 5 years at most, in my opinion. This plasmonic structure already used for many other things, like sensing, as we will discuss next time, and many other things. But in terms of nanophotonics, they're getting close because there is no any other way to concentrate light down to really nanoscale. So, and when we want to make, to have even more dense packaging in our chips, we have to use structures which focus light down to nanoscale. But we don't want to get rid of so efficient electronics and CMOS-based silicon nanoelectronics, which works so efficiently. So the hybrid type of approach is probably the future. All right, we have a little bit more time, and although that was the most important thing I wanted to discuss, I just briefly discussed with you a very nice idea how light can be guided in kind of unexpected structure, actually random structures. People nowadays are obsessed with fabricating things which are so nice. Usually it's so expensive, so time-consuming. But in many cases, stupid random structures work at least as good, sometimes provide better performance than these geometrically ordered and fabricated in a very expensive way structures. And I just give you some of these examples. Okay, coming back to photonic crystals. If you have a periodical structure, we have these band gaps so that the because of the Bragg reflection, light cannot propagate at certain frequencies. But if you create a defect, then light can propagate through this defect. This is like channel waveguides or photonic wires, well-known effect. And there is a very similar idea. It looks entirely different, but in fact quite similar. Let's assume that around linear defect, you have not a nicely nice and periodic structure, but completely random. then there is a very famous phenomenon, which is one of the most beautiful phenomena in physics, which is called Anderson localization. When light gets, because it's a random structure, very dense random structure, light gets scattered many, many times. And because of the interference during this multiple scattering, it turns out it gets trapped. It's localized. And this phenomenon is called Anderson localization. Anderson predicted this phenomenon actually for conductivity, for electrons. Now I'm speaking of Anderson localization of light. It turns out that Anderson localization can occur for all types of waves. So, and because of this multiple scattering and the interference and Anderson localization, it turns out that similar to photonic crystals, light cannot go outside of the channel. In the case of photonic crystals, because of the Bragg reflection, which is also multiple scattering and interference effect, but in perfectly periodical structure. This case, again, because of the multiple scattering and interference, but in an extremely random structures, light also cannot go outside of this defect. You see, two extremes find itself to be very similar. It's like dielectrics. You consider extremely periodic structure, and you obtain this unique property that light cannot go inside of that periodic structure because of this Bragg reflection. And then you take extremely random structure, and it turns out that the final effect is the same. Because of the multiple scattering and interference, it still cannot go outside there. So, and it, therefore, the guiding through this channel in nicely periodical structure, and the guiding in this channel made an extremely random structure. It's not just similar. As experiments done by my friend Bajewolny in Denmark, it turns out the guiding in this structure is more efficient. And of course, this is cheap to do. I mean, this is just random distribution of stupid metal particles, and this is very expensive to do. This was a funny thing, but I mean, he demonstrated the guiding in this structure is more efficient. Well, and so this is just, again, reminds you how it works in photonic crystals. This is structures fabricated by Bajewolny in Denmark. He would take different channels, one more narrow, another broader one. And this is, of course, you see the surface is strongly corrugated. And so this is how he fabricates it. It's easy. It's not that important. And so he measured again with a near-field optical microscope, the instrument of choice. You locally can look how strong is the field. And here is the result. You see that through this channel, light propagates. Well, of course, and he looks at the propagation at different wavelengths. And when you scan, when he scans in the direction perpendicular to the channel, okay, here you have light inside of the channel. Here you don't have a light at all. It doesn't penetrate there because of the Anderson localization. And here there is another channel again. It does go through. This wavelength's not that much. This wavelength's quite a bit. So, and when you look how fast the energy decays into this random structure because of the Anderson localization, it's pretty fast. So he actually measured the lengths within which this surface plasmon localized. It turned out to be, well, this something like 7 micron. So, and he can also show that you can bend this excitation. You can make a channel actually bend, and you can guide this light through this channel surrounded by extremely random structure. And the conclusion for this particular part, that successful demonstration of waveguiding of surface plasmon polariton in these extremely random structures is also possible. So when you create linear defects or linear channel in structures surrounded rather than by perfectly periodical structures like in photonic crystals, actually extremely random structure. That's very, very interesting. So he demonstrated confinement in disordered media because he showed that light really doesn't go into the random structure because of the Anderson localization. And this is the conclusion that the random media couple perhaps complement photonic crystals in future work. I guess he was too shy here. Personally, he said to me that these random structures worked better. I guess if he would write it in that paper, it would not get published because everybody believed in photonic crystals. How come such ugly random structures could provide performance nearly as close, but in fact better than photonic crystals? So as my friend, another friend says, life is not as simple as it looks sometimes. It's even more simple. Okay, I'll see you on Thursday.